verses that you were talking about, Quran and Itra. Remember, we were talking about this in the program, in the last program.
Yes.
The man who changed the world and still is. This is the problem that enemies of Islam have with the character of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Exactly. I mean, what I was going to ask you, and to be honest, you know, we're really referring to a book that has been recently been published on Imam Khomeini, and it's an anthology. It's the composition of a variety of academics, of scholars, of people who are analysts in this particular field of studying great figures of history, the people who really shape events. And of course, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has had such an impact that this anthology is about 400 pages compiled by people of international repute, academics and professors of various expertise who are literally gobsmacked, if I could put it that way, by the Imam, who was a humble teacher, a student of the Hawza, a man of great purity, of great spirituality. And we discussed that in the previous programs. We discussed this aspect of his being close to his beloved, and he's written poetry accordingly. There are poems by Imam Khomeini about speaking about this mystical aspect of this relationship that he wanted with God, which is very rare, of course, because you and I were discussing before that in the late century, religion was something that was basically put in a closet.
Was it taboo?
Well, I mean, it was not something relevant.
I mean, if you really tried to practice religion back then,
right?
You know, you would, in some different circumstances, you should be ashamed of yourself, according to them.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is.
You should feel bad.
Well, I mean,
why are you praying?
Exactly. I mean, the thing.
Don't pray. This is what they used to say.
Yeah, in terms of the West, I mean, as far as you and I, because of course you've lived in America and I've lived in the United Kingdom for most of my life. The thing that draws to us is that, you know, this was a personal thing, you know, that, you know, if you have a spirituality, it's like a phase that you go through, right? But Imam Khomeini was the embodiment of one of the great divine religions that have been revealed to the world, which is Islam. And he comes out of that tradition. And he's made such an impact that he's left the rest of the world still searching and going through all their databases again about exactly what has this man done. And, you know, as you say, as you quite rightly pointed out, the title of the program is The Man Who Changed the World. And what we are puzzled by is the ingredients that make up Imam Khomeini, because we've touched on these aspects of his personality, his character, his courageousness, his bravery in terms of speaking out against Zulm. As far as Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, he was doing his duty as far as the agenda, or as far as the briefing that was concerned from the Quran.
And let's not forget the ingredients, the main ingredients was divine teaching. I'm going to refer to this.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm saying here is that in terms of this connection between the Prophet's legacy, which the Imam reiterated again in his will at the end of his life, and he says, and he begins by that tradition, that very famous hadith that we quote over and over again, that there are two things that the Holy Prophet was leaving behind. The one was the Quran, and the other was the itrati, the family.
Two heavy things or two valuable things at the same time.
At the same time.
Right.
And the Imam lives up to both of these things.
That's why he became Imam.
That's why he became Imam. So, the question is, why so much emphasis on this legacy for the rest of the Muslim world? And why is in spite of all the resources that are available to the West, and it was to the East as well, in terms of their intelligence, in terms of their analysis, in terms of their academia, and of course, you know, we don't belittle them in any way. When we speak of Harvard, we speak of Oxford, we speak with respect for these institutions. Yet, why don't they have an answer for Imam Khomeini? Why are they struggling?
My answer to that important question is this: because they are acting.
Right.
If you act, you cannot be yourself. Imam Khomeini was not acting.
Right.
He was himself.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing. The main ingredients that I said a couple seconds ago,
mm-hmm.
divine teaching.
Right.
You talk about Quran here.
Mm-hmm.
And who's gonna teach us Quran? Prophet.
Yes.
According
but
to Quran.
But you don't have Prophet just now.
Well, but he has done his mission.
Mm-hmm.
During 23 years of hardship.
So that we wouldn't be without him.
Because he did it because we shouldn't go astray after him.
Exactly. And I was
should stay on the right path. And Imam Khomeini, mm-hmm. peace be upon him, did that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to give you so many references from Quran, okay?
Right, go ahead. Go ahead.
Let me give you examples.
Right,
let's
put this into our context.
When you study Imam Khomeini's life,
yeah.
okay,
mm-hmm.
this is not a lullaby for us.
Yeah.
This is something for us to pick the reference, the passage, the address. Why are we supposed to do this or that? When you hear about what Imam... Let me give you one example.
Sure.
It is said that Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, when he was thirsty, mm-hmm. you know, asking for a glass of water, whatever,
mm-hmm.
okay, he drank half of it. He put a piece of napkin on top,
mm-hmm.
to save the rest of water,
mm-hmm.
for later on. Why he did that? We don't think about it. We said, oh,
mm-hmm.
we're looking for some different reasons. No, we have to get back to the passage, to the divine teaching. Quran tells us, "Kulu washrabu wa la tusrifu." Eat, drink,
mm-hmm.
but don't waste. Imam Khomeini was not acting for someone to take a picture or later on, you know, write it in a
right.
book.
Yeah.
To be a biography of him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He really believed in this ayah, that wasting the benefit, the gifts of God is not good.
Well, I want to interrupt you there just for a second, because what you point out there, you know, we hear this cliche over and over again. Islam is a way of life.
And the problem with that is you don't get tired of it.
Yeah, this is a way of life. Islam is a way of life. But what I want to say is, how many of us actually live that way of life or have understood that way of life? I mean, the action you've just described there for a moment with the half glass of water and the napkin, I mean, also reminds me of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, where he says, when you're doing your ablutions, you can do it with a glass of water.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You don't need to open the tap and let it run and wash your face and have a kind of semi-bath before you go for your prayer.
Because if you do so, if you waste it, that's some kind of selfish.
So
yes.
Exactly. So in other words, Imam Khomeini is literally taking what he's understood from the Quran, and although was not a masoom, but he's trying to live up to the standard of the infallibles, the 12 imams who succeeded the Holy Prophet in terms of that teaching. Because that discipline is extremely important. And if you don't have it, you can't live this way of a life of Islam.
That's why he was successful. That's why he ruled over the hearts, not bodies. This is the task of Islam. Before you conquer a country or a land, you have to gain the hearts. This is very difficult. Imam was not masoom by any means, but this is not the point.
Mm.
I mean, in Shia belief, mm-hmm. we only have 14 of them.
Yes.
But let me ask you this. Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, she wasn't masoom in this category.
No.
But what kind of wrongdoing she did?
Exactly.
This is a question. This is why I'm trying to say, to relay the message. If you read Quran, in every different passage of teaching, it tells you why don't you think in so many different levels.
Yes.
We have tafakkur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the beginning.
Yes.
Then we have ta'aqul.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to a higher level, then we have tadabbur. You have to put the pieces in order, one behind each other. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to make a caravan of thinking, of rationalizing, of understanding, deep understanding of divine teaching. And Imam did that successfully. Imam was not impeccable in that sense, but he climbed to the summit and to the top of all the perfection that we could expect from a human being. This is my point.
Yeah.
And I can give you so many different... Look, there's a verse in Quran in chapter Anfal, the spoils of war.
Spoils of war, yes. This is chapter 8, isn't
it? Exactly.
Yeah.
The verse 29 says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O those who believe. After that, there is a conditional statement. In tattaqullah. If, and that's a big if, I should say. If you fear God by staying away from what he prevents you not to do.
Prohibits you from not doing.
And do what he supposed to expect from you.
Sure.
So you become a pious.
Pious,
when you become a pious, there is a reward. In tattaqullah. What's the reward? Yaj'al lakum furqana. God gives you a power of distinction.
Right.
Imam was a distinctive man. This is a divine teaching that I'm talking about. And Prophet, peace be upon him, passed this to us. Why? Because his divine mission was complete.
Yeah.
He did exactly what God told him to do.
I mean, the thing is that, as you quite rightly point out, that this very important factor, that Imam Khomeini is actually living this divine teaching, which gives him this naturalness, this sincerity, this purity, both of his words and his action.
And by the way, he didn't do it for other people to see him.
Exactly.
He did it because he believed it.
He believes it. And
that's the difference.
That's the decisive factor.
That's why I keep saying he was not acting. He was himself. And by himself, I mean he was human first. Then, of course, he was a faithful. He was a Muslim. He was a Shia, because all different levels, you know, the expectation goes higher. He raised the bar for himself, Brother Ejaz. He raised the bar for himself. This is very important to understand.
And he was doing that to the last moment of his life. Raising the bar.
Let me give you another instant of his life.
Please.
Okay, he was walking in his surrounding. One small garden, one small flower. How many of us pay attention to small flowers, the changing of how it grows? Imam did that. So for us to see that, to read that, is one thing. But to think about it is different. Because he saw that particular small flower as ayah of Allah, as the sign of Allah.
Exactly.
The color, the smell, the beauty of the flower. He felt it. Because Allah told him to think about his gifts, his creation. Remember the incident that is famous, that one of the correspondents, the media, asked him in a plane, what is your feeling?
Yeah, that was
after?
John Simpson of the BBC.
What? The answer was what? Nothing.
Nothing.
My question to you is this. Why he didn't ask Imam, what do you mean by nothing? Think about what I just said.
Yeah. He didn't come back to him on that.
He didn't come back to him.
Yeah.
Why? Because he wasn't thinking. Then later on he took it in a negative way. And talk about it.
Yeah.
This is my point.
Yeah.
And you can elaborate on this if you want.
Yeah.
By thinking. What is your feeling after 15 years in being in exile? You're going back to your country, your homeland. What is your feeling? Imam says nothing. Because besides Allah, for Allah, from Allah, to Allah, he sees nothing. That's what he meant.
Yeah.
Anything else is just a tool. It's a device. It's not the purpose. It's not the main goal for Imam.
No.
Because the way he recognized his creator, he can see things different than other people. This is the difference.
Exactly. And this is
why
this
news reporter, why didn't he ask him, what do you mean by nothing? He could explain.
Yeah.
My answer to you is this, because he didn't want to know.
He didn't want to know, because he was afraid of what was going to be said.
Of course, because if you ask him one question, you know, he gives you another one.
He was afraid if he went into
Brother
that.
Brother, there's no end to it.
Yeah, there's no end to it. Because
if you're attached to Islam, if you're a true believer, there is no end for you.
No.
The sky is the limit.
sky's the limit. But the thing is that what the secular West, if I can put it that way, or the fact that the West has, in a sense, gone for secularism and abandoned their religiosity in many ways and spirituality in many ways, it's very hard for them to stomach what Imam Khomeini was saying over those period of the revolution, in the early days of the revolution. And, you know, that's what I come back to this anthology.
My point on that is this. Back then, you could justify that it was something new. Something new was going on.
Yeah.
But how about right now, 34 years later on?
But I would go further than that. I wouldn't even say it was something new. I would say...
No, from their own perspective.
From their perspective, I'll give you this. Because the headline in the paper said, you know, as soon as Imam Khomeini had landed at the fruit guy at the airport of Mehrabad, that he said in Tehran, it says 1,000, after 1,400 years, Islam is back. I mean, that's the headline
Islam
in the British
the
papers, which means...
Islam was back the way we could see it.
Exactly. But the
Islam always was on the...
That's the way Imam Khomeini, in this anthology, what he's done for all the academics and scholars who were so busy spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on justifying the postmodern world and the world that we are in at the moment, which we now see is falling apart. Also, thanks to many aspects that we'll discuss later on in later programs about how Imam Khomeini could have this insight into seeing the end of the East as well as the West in terms of the civilization as they know it. But as far as what we are seeing at the moment, even in this moment in time, after what Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has done, that in the smallest of actions, as you say, in one word where he said heech,
nothing.
They were quite well aware of what that heech
was. Let me
finish this point, because the thing is that in that heech, they knew perfectly well what that meant.
That one particular word, you can write books about it.
Exactly, because this word heech is saying, and that's what John Simpson was afraid of and didn't want to carry on the conversation. And this is what this anthology is also compiled about, that it's going to force him to think about God. And that is where we are at the moment, that you and I are discussing Imam Khomeini, the man who changed the world.
And still is.
But what are we really discussing here? What is the real topic behind what we're discussing here? Because the Imam loves Allah. And that love that he has for God is something that he wants to instill in all of us.
And that love comes from true understanding.
Yeah.
A deep one.
So
what we call ma'rifah,
from the passages of the Quran, as we are saying, that we say that Islam is a way of life, but really, are we doing any true justice to living that way of life as the Imam demonstrated that, look, I am a person who has lived this book, and
brother,
look what it's done.
We should try. He set the example. You know, we haven't seen any prophets, have you?
I haven't seen any, no.
Apostle,
but
messenger.
If I want,
we saw Imam Khomeini.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I said it's easy to talk about Khomeini, because we think we know him. We think we know him.
No.
So it makes it easy for us.
Yeah.
To imagine, we know him. Why? Yeah. Because we live at the same era, the same time that he did.
Yeah, but
most of us.
But we didn't grasp.
We didn't.
But
we didn't grasp the importance of
how he lived,
where he was coming from, how he lived. The root of the whole thing. And why is it difficult to understand Imam Khomeini? Because we don't try.
Yeah.
It is difficult. It's almost impossible for Western media, Western mentality, that is, in order to understand why. Because in order to meet someone, you have to take the first step. You have to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
He comes to you, you have to go to him at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is how God works. He said, if you take one step for me, I would help you.
Yeah, I'll take 10 steps towards you.
Exactly. That's why when you do something good, he rewards you 10 times.
10 times.
Bigger.
Bigger.
More.
Bigger.
But if you do something bad, he only punishes you if he doesn't forgive you.
Yeah.
So this is the point. Mm. This is the stuff that we need to talk about.
Yeah.
And the list goes on.
Yeah.
We can talk about Imam Khomeini as long as we can live. Why? Because Quran is limitless.
Exactly.
Because Etra is limitless.
Exactly.
Because they set the right path for us. On this, I can give you so many different passages and action that Imam took. Remember Shuar Nazir?
Yes, I remember.
Edward?
Yeah.
The Soviet Union Foreign Minister.
Remember
Secretary. After Imam sent a mission?
Yeah.
A divine mission, I should say.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the big scholar of the Hosa in Qom.
Yeah.
He sent with the message in order to explain it to Mr. Gorbachev. He didn't listen. Later on, he admitted.
Yeah.
That was one of his biggest mistakes in his life.
It says that also here. It quotes him from this anthology. He said, that was the biggest mistake of my life. I wish I had paid more attention to that delegation when they when they left that message. Because he says, when the Soviet Empire really started to disintegrate, I remembered that letter.
Mm-hmm. But that was too late. So one of the divine teaching, Brother Edwards, is that to be on the right track at the right time. Imam was at the right time, acting at the right time. He wasn't late. When Shuar Nazir came to him with the message of Mr. Gorbachev,
we pointed out.
You know what he did?
Yeah.
The way that he met him. Mm. He didn't sit, Imam Khomeini. Mm. I tell you why. Anything you hear about Khomeini, ask yourself why. Why he did that?
Mm.
Just like the example I gave you about the glass of water.
Mm.
Why he did that? There is a reason behind it. The reason you should look for to understand in Quran and Itra, in the life of the impeccables.
Yes.
When Shuar Nazir came to him, he didn't sit on a chair for Shuar Nazir to arrive into the room and for Imam Khomeini as the leader of Muslims of the world to stand up in front of someone who's not a Muslim. Think about what I just said.
Yeah.
Because you talk about the Izzah here.
Mm.
You talk about the leadership.
Mm.
Okay, he was humble. You mentioned something, you know,
yes.
A couple minutes ago.
Yeah.
You said he was humble.
Mm.
He was humble because God told him to be humble.
Exactly.
There's a passage in Quran
yes.
telling his prophet, peace be upon him. He said, when you walk on the earth, don't be arrogant. Don't walk like a king. Imam was humble with with faithful. He wasn't humble with America. He said America cannot do a damn thing. He was tough with them. Because again, in Quran, God tells us, you know,
be hard against the unbelievers.
Prophet is the messenger of God, okay, our prophet, peace be upon him.
Mm.
Whoever is with him, ashaddaa alal kuffar, tough with the enemy of God, with the blasphemous.
Yes.
But at the same time, rohamao bainahum, be gentle, be kind, be meek.
Mm.
He was meek
with
people, ordinary people.
Exactly.
But he couldn't budge in front of infidels, in front of God.
No.
He couldn't.
No.
Because that was against his belief. And the list goes on, brother. He didn't stand up in front of him. So the set was like this, that Shuar Nazir was sitting.
Yes.
Imam arrived into the room. Think about that.
Mm.
From the position of Izzah, undefeatable position that God gives every single faithful.
Mm.
If you follow the path.
Yeah.
You see my point here? Anything he did, anything you read in a book, don't just read it because it's a story of his life, which is good.
Yeah.
And we should respect.
Mm.
But think about the reason behind it.
Mm.
That's why it makes Imam Khomeini unique, I should say.
Exactly.
And he was in that sense.
Because, I mean, this is the thing that he's trying, Imam Khomeini, you know, as a teacher, and he is a teacher for us. And for, as you say, for as long as we are going to have this discussion, which is beyond our own lifetimes. But in the next session, in the next program, I'd like to concentrate more on this aspect. That, as you say,
you can pick from any part of his life.
Any part of
his life. And I can find a reference for
you. Yeah, but I'd like to talk more about the fact that he's living the Quran in this modern, postmodern era, in the context of the end of the 20th century. And yet, he's not part of that time. He's ahead of that time. He's not in that
That's
context.
That's a good subject, yeah.
He's not in that context. So I'd like to go more into that aspect, and the other aspect of the fact that for the Muslim world as well, which we need to discuss as well, is that why did he emphasize this hadith Thaqalain?
Mm-hmm.
Beware. He's fully aware that there are other schools of...
In his will and last
testament. There are other schools of Muslim thought that, of course, as a jurisprudent, as a walayat al-faqih, he is an expert on this aspect, but he emphasizes this, and we need to look into that, that why the imam, even through the process of this
and
Islam...
And we should keep that in mind
This process of Islamic awakening that we're seeing now is so important, even for this particular movement as it's happening at this juncture. Thank you very much, Dr. Hasni, really, for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate your valuable contribution, and we'll hopefully discuss further these aspects in the next program. Thank you for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. I hope you enjoyed the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessing of Allah be upon you all.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. There's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire...
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at number 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown.
Oh,
The premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade, and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and secondhand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember, actually, was back in the 1970s, when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over about 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carrying on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that. So it's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut, but unfortunately when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite Trade Union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite Union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claim the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least through the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The U.S. and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
Months after a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for two decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called war on terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. It was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan Commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment, and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli prime minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as a root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
What did Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham say about the 6th of January rioting at the United States Capitol? And when did they say it? Were they suitably censorious of the violence? At the time, did their public remarks match their private horror? The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Frank Bruni, a contributing opinion writer with more than 25 years' experience. The article is titled, "The Line from Fox News to Trump's Big Lie is Short and Direct." Did Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham say about the 6th of January rioting at the United States Capitol? And when did they say it? Were they suitably censorious of the violence? At the time, did their public remarks match their private horror? Those questions have been heatedly and extensively hashed out over the days since the House Committee released text messages from 6th of January, in which Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, the popular host of primetime shows on Fox News, separately implored President Donald Trump's chief of staff to get Donald Trump to say and do something to disperse the protesters and quell the violence. Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham knew that he had stirred those protesters and could sway them, more so than they ever acknowledged on air, according to their critics. According to Hannity and Ingraham, they're just the victims, yet again, of left-wing media smears. You can delve into the weeds of this, or you can pull back and survey the whole ugly yard. And what you see when you do that, what matters most in the end, is that Fox News has helped to sell the fiction that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. And there's a direct line from that lie to the rioting. There's a direct line from that lie to various Republicans' attempts to develop mechanisms to overturn vote counts should they dislike the election results. That lie is the root of the terrible danger that we're in, with Donald Trump's supporters being encouraged to distrust and undermine the democratic process. And that lie has often found a welcome mat at Fox News. The Washington Post media critic Eric Wemple is among the many attuned observers who have documented this, and a column of his from mid-January 2021 presented a compendium of inciting commentary on Fox News Channel in the lead-up to 6th of January. Interviewing Donald Trump on 29th of November 2020, the Fox business host, Maria Bartiromo, declared, "We cannot allow America's election to be corrupted. We cannot." On Sean Hannity's show just 2 days later, the Fox News host, Jeanine Pirro, vented an apocalyptic outrage about Joe Biden's election victory, saying, "This fraud will continue and America will be doomed for the next 20 years. The Fox News contributor Newt Gingrich, the Fox business host Lou Dobbs, Sean Hannity himself, all of them got in on the action to some degree or other, stating or signaling that something about the 2020 presidential election was terribly amiss. But where is their evidence? It was fugitive then, and no one has tracked it down since. That's because it doesn't exist. It's a conspiracy-minded, ratings-driven hallucination. Just this week, the Associated Press published a review of every potential case of voter fraud in the 6 battleground states where Donald Trump has disputed Joe Biden's victory. It found fewer than 475 cases. Joe Biden won Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and their 79 Electoral College votes by a combined 311,257 votes out of a total of 25.5 million ballots cast for president, the Associated Press reported. The disputed ballots represented just 0.15% of his victory margin in those battleground states. The cases could not throw the outcome into question, even if all the potentially fraudulent votes were for Joe Biden, which they were certainly not, and even if those ballots were actually counted, which in most cases they were not. This mathematical analysis hardly supports the hysteria on the right, a hysteria that Fox News readily whips up. I direct you to the so-called documentary Patriot Purge on Fox Nation, in which Tucker Carlson recasts 6th of January as evidence that a corrupt government is setting up and locking up Donald Trump's supporters, who are really political prisoners. And this is no garden variety partisan hysteria. It circles around and sometimes lands squarely on the contention that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president and Donald Trump is our rightful ruler, exiled to the Siberia of southern Florida. I know the pushback from the right. It was Democrats who refused to accept Donald Trump's legitimacy by insisting that he, in cahoots with Russia, cheated his way into the Oval Office. They rushed the judgment as more than a few sympathetic journalists indulged or floated Rococo scenarios well beyond anything provable. But, Democrats weren't passing or trying to pass laws in battleground states that would enable them to counter the popular will. Democrats weren't trying to enshrine rule by the minority. Many Republicans are doing precisely that right now. And they're being motivated and cheered on, both directly and obliquely, by what they see and hear on Fox News Channel. I care less about Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham's precise words on 6th of January than about what they and their colleagues on Fox News said before and after, and what they're saying right now. It's reckless, it's subversive, and it's scary.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Islamic view on wealth. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will look at the Islamic view on wealth in the Islamic life style. According to the Islamic lifestyle, well, before we talk about the Islamic view, it is better to talk about the worldview which we can see in today's world, non-Islamic view. According to the non-Islamic worldview, money and wealth, or wealth and property, is the ultimate goal of people. It means that becoming rich is the ultimate goal. And the person who is rich, who have money, who has wealth and properties, he is known as most honorable person. He is known as a noble person. So the nobility and being honorable, the criteria that what we see in today's world, according to the worldview that we have, this worldview tells us that this nobility and this honorable like being honorable, has come from the wealth. And people respect more those people who have money as compared to those who do not have. So this money, having a good car or the expensive car, having bungalows, I don't know, many houses, properties, and all those, these things are the criteria of people giving respect to others. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the Islamic view on the wealth, and we said that according to the worldview, obviously money and wealth is the main goal, and people who are rich are considered as most respectful in the general life or according to this material world. Whereas according to Islam, when we look at the wealth, Islam says that this wealth and property that you has made, that you have made your ultimate goal, this is a tool and nothing else. It is a tool in order to reach to the actual goal. And the actual goal is the perfection and spirituality. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us to become perfect, to be good human beings, to be the perfect human beings, to reach to the spirituality and have this inner peace through the actual and real spirituality. Therefore, Islam says that the wealth that you have and the properties that you have, these are the tools which will take you towards your goal. And if this tool, which is wealth and property, if it takes you towards the actual goal, then obviously it is desirable. But if it takes you away from the real goal, which is reaching to perfection and spirituality, if it takes you away, then obviously this is not desirable. This is something which is strictly forbidden in Islam. Therefore, if we want to have a good wealth and property, we need to see whether are we using it as a tool to reach to perfection, or we have made this our ultimate goal and we've went away from the perfection. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.